This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. In Colorado, fewer students of color are graduating with a post-secondary certificate or college degree than their white counterparts. And this impacts what jobs they can get.
This is an opportunity for those underserved populations, underrepresented populations in our colleges and universities to get a leg up on life, set them on a different path.
We'll look at changing how we educate the workforce of the future.
Postcards. You might think of them as analog versions of Instagram. Coming up, we'll hear how the search for one specific kind of postcard has turned into a quest for one Estes Park man.
Plus, we'll hear a review of the new Italian movie Dog Man and so much more. But first, we had to report on another tragedy this week, the shooting at STEM school Highlands Ranch.
One student was killed and eight others were injured. Two suspects allegedly walked into the school with handguns Tuesday afternoon and shot at students in two separate locations. Both of the suspects are students at STEM and they're both in custody. Douglas County Sheriff Tony Spurlock said the investigation will take time.
We are still actively working the crime scene with our partners from the FBI. We anticipate that that's probably going to take at least two more days for us to manage that.
The two suspects have already made their first appearances in court.
One of the two vigils held on Thursday for the victims turned into a counter vigil led by STEM students. KUNC's Michael DeIoanna was there.
In a packed gym, they listened to politicians, including Senator and presidential candidate Michael Bennett. They heard from members of Team Enough, the youth group of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. But no STEM students were expected to speak, so they went outside.
I'm not going to stand by and let them politicize us!
Dozens gathered in the cold rain, holding their mobile phones up with the lights on. They said they wanted to grieve, away from the TV cameras. Castillo died on Tuesday, giving his own life to save others. Eight more were also injured in the shooting.
This is for everyone else who's in that school with this little...
Michael DeIoanna, KUNC.
In the wake of this week's shooting at STEM school Highlands Ranch, parents all over Colorado are again struggling with difficult conversations about school safety. Incidents like this are traumatic events that can have long-lasting consequences, especially for children. Aditi Bunlamudi has reported on children and trauma for our partner Guns and America, and she joins me now.
Thanks for having me.
So there's no doubt this is a deeply frightening experience for the kids at the STEM school. Honestly, it's frightening for everyone. What can parents do to best support their kids in the immediate aftermath of an event like this?
So the most important thing you can do is talk to your kids. Be very open with them. I spoke with Robin Gerwich, a psychologist with the Duke Medical Center, and she says it's crucial to have these conversations early.
It would be great if we could say, oh, don't worry about it, don't feel that way. That's unrealistic. So we have to make sure that we support them, but to let them know that our own feelings. It's all right to say, this makes me worried, or this makes me scared, or this makes me angry, but here's what we're going to do. Here's how I'm going to cope with it.
So basically, when you start the conversation, if you start by asking, what have you heard? You know, I heard this school shooting happened. What have you heard? That sort of opens the conversation up for them to tell you what they've been hearing. And it allows you to sort of see what they've taken in from the situation. But it also allows you to gently correct anything that they might have gotten wrong. This is not a one and done thing. You know,
right.
Signs of trauma, appear early. They can appear, right when things are happening. They can appear months later. So it's important to keep checking and keep asking, you know, how are you doing with all of this?
Which brings up a great point. You know, what about the weeks and months that follow? What exactly should parents be watching out for?
So kids vary in responses, similar to adults. You know, there are some kids in the immediate aftermath have very heightened levels of response and grief. And there are some kids who don't show signs of trauma for months after. So it's always it's always important to monitor how a child is responding to these things. You know, be aware of their sleeping patterns, of their eating habits. Therapy for kids who are immediately affected by this is really important, and it's better to get help sooner rather than later. Dr. Gerwich, who I talked to, said, you know, even months, years after, some kids may respond to situations, you know, the same way that they responded to it the first time it happened. So there may be triggering incidences that happen. So it's always, you know, important to be aware of that.
There are times, even long after an event, where we may have be triggered or we may have those same reactions that we had initially. And those often occur around anniversaries or when similar events happen.
Right now, we are in this period where the Columbine anniversary happened. We had a shooting in Charlotte and now Denver. So these can all have compounding effects on children who may be triggered by this already. So it's just important to monitor this and be aware of things that may be coming up.
How does this vary depending on how old your child is? I mean, what should parents of younger kids be thinking about when these events are in the news?
Well, when I talked to Gerwich, she mentioned something very important about media consumption. You know, for small kids, it's important to have them consume as least the least amount of media possible about this. You know, just because a child is in the room on an iPad and they don't seem to be paying attention, it doesn't mean that they're not listening. Mm. So it's very important to make sure that they're not consuming a lot of it. For older kids, you know, you can watch stuff around them, but don't keep it on for hours on end. Just turn it off after a while and always talk about it. Always follow up with, you know, we saw this happen. How do you feel? Where are you at right now? It's always important to keep that conversation going.
Absolutely. Aditi Bundlamudi is a Guns and America reporting fellow based at WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
And there's more coverage of this on our website, kunc.org.
For years, postcards were kind of the text of the communication world, a way to send a few quick lines to someone with a photo or artwork on the front to brighten their day. But for one Estes Park archivist, the search for one specific kind of postcard has turned into a decade-long quest. KUNC arts reporter Stacey Nick has more.
John Meisner strolls into Greeley Antique Shop, Lincoln Park Emporium, and right away, a display of postcards near the counter catches his eye.
These are amazing because you never see, this is like new old stock. So they're perfect. It's like they just came from the printer.
The cards, which are placed next to some boxes of candy, depict Colorado tourist spots such as Red Rocks. They're all from Denver's Sanborn Souvenir Company. The cost? 25 cents a piece.
Which is a very fair price, and it just shows you postcards right now are tough to sell.
But not all of them. These are from Bill Sanborn and were shot in the 1960s and 70s. Now, a postcard by his father, Harold Sanborn.
That can be a $100 or a $200 card.
Why so much for what is essentially just a piece of paper? Harold Sanborn started the Sanborn Souvenir Company out of downtown Denver in the 1920s. For the next 40 years, the commercial photographer traveled throughout Colorado and Wyoming, taking pictures of local places of note, anything he thought might make a marketable postcard. Now Meisner goes from town to town, scouring antique shops and flea markets on the hunt for Sanborn postcards. And most of the time, he comes up empty-handed.
Most of these are chromes or printed or lithographs, but there are some very interesting real photo postcards in here.
Thanks to careful notes still kept by the current owner of the Sanborn Souvenir Company, no relation to Harold, Meisner knows that over his career, Sanborn shot more than 10,000 different views for his real photo postcards.
We know how many he produced, but we don't know the views.
To prevent his photos from appearing dated and keep them commercially viable, Sanborn took photos without people or vehicles in them.
But the problem is they look somewhat lifeless and somewhat flat.
But that's not what Meisner and many other collectors throughout Colorado and the country are interested in. It's the connection to local history.
He made an attempt to go into every town and city in Colorado and Wyoming and take their civic buildings, their churches, their courthouses, their post offices, but also their smaller businesses. So their restaurants, their cottage courts, their gas stations.
Which is why Meisner helped found the Estes Park Archives, a group of armchair archaeologists working to curate a collection of memorabilia from the town's past, everything from photographs to phone books. Since Sanborn shot a large percentage of his work here, his postcards have become a focal point for the group.
Yes, it might be something common. Yes, it might be Long's Peak. And we have plenty of pictures of Long's Peak. But it may be a business that existed in the Big Thompson Canyon. Or it may be a cottage that was in Glen Haven that this is the only picture we're ever going to have of it.
But after 10 years of searching around the country, they've only found 60% of Sanborn's postcards from the area. Now they're reaching out to the community for help.
We spread the word. We let people know, here's what we're interested in. If you've got postcards, even if they're not Sanborn's, we're very interested in looking at them. We're active buyers of them.
They've spent into the six figures obtaining the collection so far. Eventually, they'll sell the duplicates and create a book on the postcards, along with a digital archive so that anyone can see the cards online. About two-thirds of the way through the box in front of him, John Meisner gets a smile on his face.
Here's a Sanborn.
It's an image of Echo Lake looking out towards Mount Evans. The card is from 1928, but it's a printed card, what those in the business call a linen card.
I'm actually going to set that aside because I may end up buying them.
It's not one of the real photo postcards he's looking for, although it is very collectible. But behind it all, Meisner says what he really hopes is to inspire other citizen historians like himself.
And I think that benefits everyone. I think the more that we learn and the more that we share, the more that we understand our past, which helps us kind of understand where we're going.
In the end, Meisner did end up buying that postcard.
Okay, your total is going to be 642.
One more Sanborn for the collection, helping to mark a moment in Colorado history. Stacy Nick, KUNC.
You can see photos of that Sanborn postcard along with other postcards from the photographer on this story at KUNC.org. Aaron, the news has been heavy, the weather has been moody, but Colorado May snow showers bring June flowers, right?
Is that how it goes now?
I think it is.
I think we're going to go with that. Yeah. I am glad to see the flowers coming up and
me
the
too.
Yards turning green.
The pollen is attacking my nose.
Sounds like spring. maybe it's better to stay indoors this weekend and watch a movie. So if you stay with us, we have a movie review from Howie Mofsovitz to hear.
But before we get to that, more than 56% of Coloradans have a certificate or college degree, making us one of the most educated states. But it's far short of what is needed for Colorado's changing workforce.
Now, one issue is the graduation rate for students of color compared to their white counterparts. Angie Piccioni is the executive director of the Department of Higher Education.
So Hispanic student population, and not just student, but adult population, is about at about 29%. African-American is about close to 40%, and Native American is about 29%.
In part of our series, Hire Me, Educating Colorado's Changing Workforce, KUNC Stephanie Daniel looks at a partnership that's preparing teenagers to work in technology fields.
Job interviews can be intimidating, especially when you're a teenager. But Adriana Guzman is prepared for the first question.
Go ahead and tell me a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a junior at Skyline High School.
The 17-year-old is trying to land a client management intern job. She's being interviewed by an IBM employee.
I am also enrolled to Front Range Community College, where I have 30 college credits.
The IBM employee is real, But this is a mock interview taking place at the Innovation Center in Longmont.
So I'm halfway done with my associate's degree.
Guzman is part of Pathways in Technology Early College High School, or PTEC, at Skyline High School. Called Falcon Tech, the program is a partnership between St. Vrain Valley School District, Front Range Community College, and IBM. Students will finish high school and earn an associate degree in computer information systems at the same time.
What we need to do is integrate the community college experience with the high school experience, so you're getting both at the same time.
Brandon Schaefer heads up PTEC for St. Vrain Valley. Falcon Tech currently has 3 grades, and the first cohort is in their junior year.
We recruited 50 students our first year and started them in their first college class, their second semester of freshman year in high school.
Former Governor John Hickenlooper signed the PTEC bill in 2015. It allows students, starting in the 9th grade, to qualify for in-state college tuition. St. Vrain Valley not only pays for their college classes while in high school, but up to 2 years after graduation.
I think this is the direction that education is ultimately going to go.
Front Range Community College provides the coursework for the students. Marty Goldberg oversees that part of PTEC.
This is an opportunity for those underserved populations, underrepresented populations in our colleges and universities to get a leg up on life, set them on a different path towards something that's meaningful, fulfilling, and has a secure future.
We have a very high Hispanic community, first generation.
That's Louise March. She's the counselor for Falcon Tech.
A lot of them are not just the first to be in college, maybe the first to graduate high school.
Hispanics are the largest and fastest growing ethnic group in the state, but less than 30% finished a higher ed program last year. It's over 60% for white students. In fact, the attainment gap between the two groups is the second highest in the nation. March counsels all the students, including Adriana Guzman. She'll be the first in her family to get a college degree.
Sometimes it's difficult to succeed when the rest of the family isn't. So they're very brave and they're breaking barriers.
PTEC was first launched at a high school in Brooklyn about 8 years ago. Since then, it's been implemented across the country.
So there's a large technology gap.
Eric Bernjan is the IBM program manager for PTEC and the Falcon Tech program. He says IBM can't fill the positions they currently have open.
So in order to really create a talent pipeline, we had to go down to the high school and community college and start, you know, a partnerships there and working towards building our own talent.
After finishing PTEC, Skyline students could be hired on at IBM or other tech companies in jobs like web development or programming. After her mock interview, Adriana Guzman is debriefing with Mariah Cantrell.
She said I also did really good, that I was really confident.
Each student is partnered with an IBM employee who also serves as a mentor. Cantrell has been Guzman's mentor since her freshman year.
Participating in and the chance to help these kids to excel is what drove me to do it.
The whole group meets for regular events like this mock interview session.
We can give them that insight of what it's really like in a professional workplace.
But PTEC students don't have to go directly into the workforce. Some will choose to go to a 4-year college like Guzman.
And they will be able to transfer my credits so I become a junior in college right away and I'll be able to get my business degree.
PTEC is gaining in popularity. Since Falcon Tech was approved in 2015, 6 more programs have opened at high schools around the state. They partner with different community colleges and businesses. Stephanie Daniel, KUNC, Longmont.
Our series, Hire Me, Educating Colorado's Changing Workforce, was produced with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. Other stories can be found at KUNC.org.
Last summer, KUNC was the first to report on a Denver landlord who refused to allow a father-son team to open a restaurant. They are Muslims of Bangladeshi descent. Now there's a settlement in the case. Reporter Michael DeJuana spoke with Kyra Buckley about it.
The father and son, the Khans, they're from Boulder, and they wanted to expand their curry and kebab restaurant to Denver. The location they wanted was being rented by Craig Caldwell, and he wanted out of his lease. Is that right?
Right. The space is in the Capitol Hill neighborhood, and Caldwell wasn't having success with his fried chicken restaurant, and he thought the Khans would be the perfect partners to work with. The only problem is his landlord, Katina Gatchis, wouldn't let him sublet to the Khans.
I met with George. George said I couldn't do it with the guy.
Caldwell, who is white, secretly recorded his conversation on his mobile phone.
Huh? How come?
No!
And that's Gatchis.
He says it's because he's a Muslim.
No!
I can't have a Muslim?
No.
How come?
Because we have, before there, we have a lot of troubles.
There are several statements like this on the tapes.
American person!
Oh, you need an American person.
American person!
Caldwell and the Khans alleged that was discrimination.
This story went viral on our website when you first reported it. So what's happened since then?
Well, the Khans received an outpouring of support from the community, and their legal battle dragged on for about a year until last month. That's when Caldwell and the Khans expected to have their day in Colorado District Court. But hours before proceedings were expected to begin, Gatchis settled.
For how much?
$675,000.
Are the Khans and Caldwell talking about it?
They are. Let's start with Craig Caldwell. He was paying rent on the space as it sat empty all this time. Now he's out of the lease, and I reached him by phone.
I couldn't believe that, people would be like that. I'd never had anything like that happen to me before. You hear about it, you see it in the news and stuff, but it was pretty shocking when it happened. And, I think hopefully this sends a message to people that you just can't be like this. There's too much hate in the world.
What do the Khans say?
I spoke to the son in the Khan team. That's Rashad. They never did get to open a restaurant in Denver, but here's what he wants people to know about the case.
It's not the norm, I guess. The outpouring of support that we've seen from the community, our friends, our family, and everybody, random people will just text me on LinkedIn, say that, hey, I read the story. I just want you to know that, we support you. Sorry this happened to you. Nobody I've ever met in my life. And, I think that it's just showing that, we're all neighbors. We live in the same community. We do live in the best country in the world where these kind of laws are enforceable.
He also said that it gives him a lot of faith in how civil rights laws have evolved over the decades.
I think that's the biggest takeaway for me was if this was anywhere else, this would have just been something that we had to live with, but we have these laws in place and people that have paved the way over the past 50 years and more that have led to a point where now that, we can fight.
Now, this seems to fly in the face of discrimination stories we often hear about. Complaints about racial, religious, and national origin discrimination are all up. They've risen steadily since 2016, according to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Iris Helpern is one of the attorneys for Caldwell and the Khans. She noticed that there was even an attempt to boycott the liquor store that Katina Gatchis runs.
During this uptick in discrimination and hate crime against racial minorities, against Muslims, against Jews that we're seeing day to day, we need to remember that, a vast majority of our society and community are good people who want to do the right thing, who will come together and who will say no to discrimination.
So the lawyers and plaintiffs in the case want people to know what can happen when people stand up against discrimination.
Yep, that's the lesson they wanted to share.
Michael DeJuana is an investigative reporter for KUNC. Michael, thanks for your story.
Always a pleasure.
The new Italian movie Dog Man is about a powerless man in a grim place. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz teaches film and television at CU Denver. He says the title not only describes the man's occupation, but his status as well.
The press notes for Matteo Garrone's Dog Man place the movie in a seaside village near a city. But it's certainly not the seaside village you have in your head at this very moment. This place looks like a wasteland, with no view of the sea, and a few battered apartment blocks clustered together. There aren't many people around, and when a few do gather, it's hard to figure where they come from. There's a line of low-slung, mostly empty spaces that could be shops. The most prominent bears the sign Dog Man, where Sad Sack Marcello Fonte, runs a dog grooming service. He's a hapless-looking man with a sloping forehead who shifts from foot to foot and nods his head when he talks to people. He often steps backwards as if he's in retreat. The film opens on a snarling dog with a heavy chain around its neck, standing in a metal basin. Marcello can barely get near the dog to wash it, but after a quick fade, Marcello's blow-drying the dog, who seems calm and happy to luxuriate in the warm air. So Marcello has a gentle way with dogs. But you can't ignore all the other dogs in metal cages in the back of this grubby shop. It's the kind of jarring, unsettled image that director Matteo Garrone never tries to resolve. You're stuck with the contradictions. Marcello's a loving father to his young daughter. They play together and take scuba diving trips. He plays soccer with friends. And he sells cocaine, but apparently to just one customer. That's Simone Eduardo Pesce, the local bully. He's huge with a thick neck. He looks like Luca Brasi, the scary thug from The Godfather. No one has the nerve or the muscle to stand up to Simone, and when Marcello and his buddies sit around together, they talk about how they can't call the cops, but they know that someone eventually will kill Simone. That talk brings up the maxim of the Russian playwright Chekhov: if you show a gun in the first act, it had better go off in the third. But writer-director Garrone doesn't take Dogman where you expect. The film's loaded with mixed tones, and wonder about how Marcello will handle Simone as Simone's demands grow bigger. Simone forces Marcello to help in petty crimes, but his ambitions keep growing. The film mixes locations to show Marcello's instabilities. From the barren village, the film jumps to a forest, which feels magical as people walk their dogs through a maze of tall, straight trees. The woods seems to have no connection with the so-called village, and the only recognizable character is Marcello. Marcello with his daughter underwater is also an escape to another temporary reality, where the usual rules don't apply. Eventually, Marcello goes for vengeance, but that too feels like a trip to an unfamiliar place. He doesn't know how to do it. He's a timid, uncertain man who may be very good with dogs or with his daughter, but he has no feel for confronting or harming other people. It's too bad, but Marcello's better at backing up than he is at going forward. Yet this is where the disparate elements of the movie snap into place. Foretelling the murder of Simone is a false lead. Dogman's about loneliness more than anything else. Dogman gains strength and richness as it moves along. At first, it's thin, and you wonder if it's headed for violence. But over time, Marcello grows more complex. And most of all, the locations themselves take on power. The barren space of the supposed seaside village becomes the space where a nobody tries to find himself and make a statement that will define his life for the better. But there's no way for that to happen in this dustbin that looks more and more like the grim cityscapes of the great Italian neorealist movies of the 1940s, where possibility is not possible. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
One last magical thing before we get out of here.
Okay, I see what you did there. Of course, you're talking about Denver's municipal election. It was held Tuesday, and just about a third of the city's registered voters cast ballots. The mayor's race appears to be going to a runoff election in June between incumbent Michael Hancock and Jamie Gillis. Is that the magical thing that you're talking about, Carly?
Not exactly. Unofficial election results show Denver is the first city in the nation to decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms.
Whoa.
KUNC's Esther Honig reports that ballot measure clutched a slight majority.
Tuesday night's results showed 301 trailing in the polls. But the latest vote count from the Denver Elections Division, which shows 301 has 50.56% of the vote. Campaign director Kevin Matthews says he spent the day on pins and needles and was overwhelmed with emotion when he heard the final results.
Our victory today is a clear signal to the rest of the country that Americans are ready for a conversation around psilocybin, and especially that no person deserves to be criminalized for using a mushroom.
The ordinance will take effect as soon as next year once a review panel has been created. Esther Honig, KUNC. What a world we live in, Carly.
It is such an interesting place. This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. If you enjoy listening and you're not a member, you can make a tax-deductible gift in any amount at any time at kunc.org.
Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode, including the special ones.
We've created one for Stephanie Daniels' Hire Me series on Colorado's changing workforce. You'll hear all of the stories in that series, plus some bonus content that's really cool.
Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.